I'm so glad. I say this every time I come, but I mean it. I'm so glad we can get together this way. I feel so important. I'd like to begin by sharing something that has brought me a lot of happiness. We ended a 10-day retreat just last Friday, a 10-day retreat at Vallecitos Mountain Refuge up in northern New Mexico, up in the mountains. Amazing place. One thing that was very gratifying about that retreat is that a large portion of the people who were in retreat were actually working at very deep levels of practice. And what's happening now, it just delights me, is that actually more and more people are actually having deep breakthrough experiences, liberating experiences. You know, the Buddha described four stages of liberating insight, progressive stages. And at each of those stages, I think I mentioned in the instructions for the meditation, the Buddha said it's very simple, that that freedom is basically freedom from those qualities of mind that torment us. Freedom from greed, freedom from hatred, forms of aversion, and freedom from ignorance. And at each of these stages of liberating insight, those qualities are reduced. And eventually the Buddha said that they actually disappear from our consciousness. If you can imagine living without fear ever. We're more and more getting people who are coming to the first stage of liberating insight. It's called stream entry. And it's very gratifying. It's actually very significant. And I think the reason that that's happening is that there's a real maturing of the practice community now in the West, here in North America and Europe. After decades of working at it, it's working. The reason I'm sharing that with you is that I think we think that, you know, this enlightenment business is for sure about somebody else. You know, it can't possibly happen to me. Well, it's happening to people. And essentially, if we do this practice, you know, and if we stay with it, we have, you know, it's the Buddha said the Dharma is good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good at the end. So it really benefits us. And the more we do this practice, the more profound the benefits. So just by way of encouragement, I also like to start with some wonderful wisdom from Calvin. That's not the French theologian, 16th century theologian John Calvin, and Hobbes. Hobbes is not the Thomas Hobbes, the 17th century English philosopher, but Calvin and Hobbes. You know, it's been 14 years since Bill Watterson stopped doing Calvin and Hobbes, so some people here may not actually know what it is. It's a cartoon that used to appear in newspapers about a six-year-old boy and his tiger. To everyone else, it's a stuffed tiger, but whenever he's alone, it's a living tiger. And so this is from Calvin and Hobbes. And for those of you who are a little bit familiar with Calvin and Hobbes, there's kind of one motif that runs all the way through. And that is, in the winter, they're on a toboggan, going, being philosophical and going down these absolutely harrowing places. And then during the summer months, they're in this little red wagon, going at horrific speeds in harrowing places. So this is a little red wagon sequence, and they're starting out by Hobbes, the tiger, is pushing the wagon, and Calvin is steering. To get it started, and then Hobbes jumps on the back. And Calvin begins by saying, "It's true, Hobbes, ignorance is bliss." And now they're going at absolute breakneck speed through the forest. Once you know things, you start seeing problems everywhere. And once you see problems, you feel like you ought to try to fix them. and fixing problems follow this matchless logic. And fixing problems always seems to require personal change. And change means doing things that aren't fun. I say fooey to that. And now they're going down this incredibly steep thing, and you know, Hobbes is holding on like this. Calvin is looking around, talking to him. But if you're willfully stupid, you don't know any better. So you can keep doing whatever you like. And now they're going at absolutely breakneck speed. The secret to happiness is short-term stupid self-interest. And then Hobbes says, we're heading for that cliff. And Calvin, who was steering, you know, puts both of his hands over his eyes and says, I don't want to know about it. And they go over the cliff screaming, and then they're down on the ground, and actually Calvin's head is buried in the ground. His little cart is completely destroyed. And Hobbes says, I'm not sure I can stand so much bliss. And then Calvin says, careful, we don't want to learn anything from this. So you heard it here first. So I want to talk about actually the gnarliest subject that anybody ever talks about when they give Dharma talks, and I don't know why I'm doing. I guess I do know why I'm doing this, but it, you know, it'd be so much easier to talk about bliss and rapture and wisdom and equanimity and but here, you know, these Dharma teachers keep showing up and they keep talking about the same very difficult topic, which is no self. So here's yet another talk on this subject, and it just particularly interests me right now. Why is it important? The founder of Soto Zen, Dogen Zenji, one of the great Buddhist teachers from the 12th century. Dogen Zenji said, "We study the self in order to forget the self. We forget the self in order to be one with all things." You know, there's probably no greater spiritual cliche than being one with all things. And yet, it's one thing to talk about it, it's one thing to spin words about it, it's another thing actually to experience it. And that's part of the blessing that comes from being free from the illusion of there being a separate self here. So I'd like to talk about why it's important, and if you'll forgive me, I'm going to get a little technical for a short time and then I'll stop. But one of the things that we do traditionally, and I actually did it at the beginning of giving instructions for the meditation this evening, is that we say our suffering comes from our grasping at what is pleasant and trying to hold on to it, which absolutely cannot work because everything passes away. So it's a self-defeating strategy to hold on to whatever Calvin is saying. It's a self-defeating strategy to try to hold on to what we want that is pleasant in our lives. And our suffering comes from our resisting what is unpleasant to us, what we don't want. Trying to get rid of it or trying to keep it away. And that doesn't work either because our lives are this constant alternation of pleasant and unpleasant and neutral experience. So that strategy doesn't work. And we normally describe that as being the cause of the pain and difficulty in our lives. And up to a point, it's true. But there's actually a more fundamental cause for the pain and difficulty in our lives. And that is not understanding what is true and believing to be true what isn't true. it's ignorance or delusion. And the way that here we're getting technical, but the Buddha actually described how we create and maintain suffering in a very beautiful teaching called the, now I know your eyes will glaze over, but called the 12 Steps of Dependent Origination. It's an amazing teaching because each thing happens because something else has happened, and there's this chain of events. He said, this is exactly how we get into this pickle and how we keep ourselves in this pickle. And he said the very first step of this chain of dependent causes for our suffering is ignorance. And the Buddha said, if you remove ignorance, the entire chain falls apart. So the business about grasping and resisting comes quite a bit further along. They appear in that chain, but they appear further along in the chain. The primary cause of our suffering is our not understanding the truth. And what happens in this practice, among other things, is that we come to understand what is true, not because we've heard it from somebody, but because we've actually observed reality long enough and discovered it for ourselves. So this is actually an empirical process, just like science. You're using the mind as an instrument for observation, and when it is very well honed and becomes very powerful, it is an extraordinary instrument of observation, and you observe masses of data. And at some point, observing masses of data, based on the data, the discovery of the truth just comes as an intuitive understanding. So the reason why we talk so much about self and no self is that we're ignorant about a number of things, we're deluded about a number of things, but really the core thing that we're ignorant about is that we believe ourselves to be separate. There's a me here and an it out there. You know? There's this. This is me. And everything else is not me. And it's that delusion, that separating off of reality, which is so much the cause of pain and suffering in the world. It's the primary cause. So as soon as we believe that there's something here, then it has to be gratified and it has to be defended. And hence greed and hence hatred. You know, we can look at the difficulties in our own lives, and we can look at the difficulties in our society, and we can look at the difficulties, the global difficulties, including climate change and the, you know, disastrous consequences of all this. And ultimately, it comes down to this ignorance. If we were to get past this delusion that we are separate, you know, it's like we're creating this confined little coffin and then we're inhabiting it. If we could get past that delusion, if that delusion just disappeared for all 6.5 billion of us humans, this world would transform. All by itself, institutions would change. War would disappear. Social injustice and economic injustice would disappear because it just our relationship to reality would be utterly changed. We study the self in order to forget the self. We forget the self in order to be one with all things. Just imagine if you could just sort of put yourself in a moment of imagination, and imagine yourself talking to someone and knowing utterly that they are you. Utterly knowing that. How would your relationship be different? Everybody, including the most difficult people, if you know that they're you, your relationship is entirely different. I heard something fantastic yesterday. Governor Mark Sanford, the Republican governor of South Carolina, most of you know that he's gotten into big trouble. He was one of those wonderful lights that Republicans were hoping would help them to re-win the White House. And his prospects for the presidency went up in smoke yesterday because he admitted that he had been having an extramarital affair, and it was particularly difficult because he's condemned Bill Clinton and a bunch of other people. But he had a news conference yesterday, and one of the things he said is the biggest self of the self is in fact self. I'm not making this up. The biggest self of the self is in fact self. The self did it. The self went off and had that affair. It's the self's fault. On some level it's true, but it's that there isn't a self. There never was a self. There never could be a self. It's utterly delusional. We all carry that delusion. So it wasn't actually the self that was the problem, Mark. It's the delusion that one is a self. And so there's a self that needs to be gratified. And once you really want to gratify it, then you have to get into all this lies and deception, and it's familiar ground to all of us. So the importance of taking on this question is that by going to this question of self or not self, essentially we're going to the root of the problem, the core of the problem. And when you're working at the root of the problem, you're also working at the root of the solution. So, I'm going to just sort of try to share with you a little bit of a perspective I have around this subject, because it's such a difficult subject. And Ajahn Chah, the great 20th century Thai Buddhist teacher, was asked, "Is there a self?" And he said, "Not exactly." And somebody said, "Well, is there not a self?" And he said, "Not exactly." I so appreciate Mr. Cha that clarification. But I'd like to just kind of work an analogy. Stay with me, if you would. I'd like to work an analogy that may be useful. And I'd like to talk about the state of New Mexico. So it's, we became a state. Those of us who are residents of the state, I'm going to say we, but I understand there may be people who are not here in this room. We became a state in 1912. The state of New Mexico is quite important to us. It has a political system, it has a judiciary, it has laws that we either obey, and if we don't obey, there are consequences. We pay taxes, we register our car, we get our driver's license. It's all very consequential, the state of New Mexico. But if you were to start walking from here and just walked over the land north, going north, you wouldn't know when you came to Colorado. You simply wouldn't know. A few weeks ago, a couple of friends and I had a wonderful time taking the Cumbres and Toltec Railroad, which is a narrow-gauge antique railroad that goes between Antonito and southern Colorado and goes up over a 10,000-foot pass and to Chama in New Mexico. And the docent said that actually the Cumbres and Toltec actually crosses the New Mexico-Colorado line 11 times in something like 64 miles, 67 miles, something like that. And it's really funny because there's a sign, you're going along and there's a sign, entering Colorado. And then a few hundred yards further down, entering New Mexico, entering Colorado, entering New Mexico. It goes on and on. And there's no line. There's just a sign. So from the perspective of the land, the land is whole. It's an integral whole. And what we have done is we've created a conceptual reality out of our heads. And the only reality it has is conceptual. And we've said there are political states. And essentially what we do with our heads is we divide up the land into a conceptual grid. and we believe it's divided. From the point of view of the land, it's undivided. Does this make sense?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this conceptual reality that we call political states, they're actually quite important. You know, when we stopped, not all of us, but when humans, many humans, stopped being hunters and gatherers some tens of thousands of years ago and started becoming agrarian, it's right then that political states started to form. And there are reasons for having them. You know, and when they're functioning well, they actually serve people well. But I think it's really important for us to remember they're only an idea, and they're a contingent idea. They're contingent on certain causes, and if those causes are removed, they disappear. So, you know, in 1988, there was an East Germany, and there was a Czechoslovakia, and there was a Yugoslavia, and they, like New Mexico, they had laws and judiciary, and people registered their cars and got their driver's licenses and did the whole thing, and had a whole history, and they don't exist anymore. You know, East Germany got assimilated into Germany. Czechoslovakia divided into the Czech Republic and Slovakia. Yugoslavia divided up into states. So that conceptual reality had usefulness up to a time, and then we abandoned it. And do you actually think that New Mexico is going to exist as a state 2,000 years from now? Probably not. That's exactly how the self is, from my experience. So, you know, does New Mexico exist? Not exactly. Does New Mexico not exist? Not exactly. It exists as a concept, as a dividing and separating concept. But from the point of view of the whole land, it doesn't exist. This is exactly how it works with the self, is that we have a concept that a certain bunch of conditions, physical conditions and mental conditions, are, we divide them off, conceptually divide them off, separate them off from the rest of reality, and we say this is a self. And it has the same contingent reality as political states. Does it exist? Not exactly. It's only a concept. Does it not exist? Well, not exactly, because it's a concept. What happens when that concept falls away? Universally, people describe it as an enormous relief. Chogyam Trungpa, the Tibetan teacher, was once asked, you know, what is self? And he said, neurosis, you're better off without it. So in some ways, the neurosis falls away. Or I've heard there's a, was it, I think it's Mingyur Rinpoche, wrote an article a while back saying, you know, it's like the experience of awakening from this dream of separation. He said, it's just like peeing. You know, just like your bladder is really full, you know, and we all know how painful that is. You know, you're driving in the car, there's no place to stop and go. We've all done that. We've all had really, really full bladders. And do you know that feeling? When you've had a chance to pee. And one of my teachers, Joseph Goldstein, described it once, and I think actually having the swamp cooler on is a great idea right now, because he said, imagine that you're sitting in the kitchen at the kitchen table having tea, and you're talking to a friend, and you're right in front of the refrigerator, and the refrigerator motor is on, and you don't notice, but you're talking over it, just as I'm talking over the swamp cooler right now. And then all of a sudden, the refrigerator motor turns off. That sense of silence, of relief. They're just metaphors. But universally, people describe the experience of being free from this very constricting concept as a very freeing, that there's a sense of lightness and clarity and spaciousness. For years now, I haven't done very much meditative. I haven't gone to many retreats myself as a retreatant, because I've been offering so many retreats to others and basically serving in that way as a teacher of retreats. And I just made a clear decision several months ago that I was going to sit more. I was going to give myself the gift of doing more retreats. And so in May, the first thing I did was to drive up to Utah, to Escalante, and meet with a dear friend of mine who's an old wilderness guide. And we backpacked together into a remote canyon in the Escalante Grand Staircase National Monument. It's a canyon that not many people know about. It's kind of hidden. And the Park Service doesn't talk about it with people because it's very pristine. There are still native fish there, for example. It's very pristine and beautiful. We packed into this unbelievable canyon, you know, red sandstone canyon. And my friend, Terry, was going to drop me off. I have a really bad back and shouldn't be backpacking. And he was going to drop me off and then go backpacking. But he's 72 and has all kinds of physical challenges. And so he couldn't go on backpacking. So we both did a self-retreat in this canyon. We found one alcove for him and one alcove for me, and we didn't have any communication for a week. We didn't see any other people for a week. You know, we were basically two geezers looking after each other in the wilderness with a satellite phone in case we had to call out. And it was amazing. It was just, I was in this alcove that was probably 200 feet high. So if you can imagine, what happened is the river, at a curve of the river, it hollowed out this sandstone. And if you can imagine being deep in the alcove, looking up in this enormous canopy of stone hanging over you. And the weather never, ever gets in there. So there were some charred stalks of grass, of reeds, that could be 3,000, could be 30,000, could be 80,000 years old, because it's never disturbed. So it was an extraordinary experience, a very wonderful experience. And after a week, we packed out. It was a lot of rapture for me. And then I drove home, and after a few days, I flew to Massachusetts to sit a 10-day retreat at Insight Meditation Society in Massachusetts, where I have done most of my practice. And I hadn't been back there for years, and I was going back to do what I call ceremonies of completion, of just going back to honor my teacher, to give a big gift to my teacher and honor him, and actually two of my teachers, and to do a ceremony of completion with IMS. I'm not expecting to go back there again. It was just wonderful being there. And I went there because of actually a gift that someone had given me to be there. So I was there on a gift certificate. And it was amazing. It was just amazing being there. There were 96 of us. There were five teachers. And I just suddenly discovered, it took me a while to pick it up, I was not expecting much from a 10-day retreat. And I was noticing that, because I track so many people in my work through these classic stages of insight that happen with people, I noticed after a few days that this mind was going through classic stages of insight. And it took me a while to figure out, oh, right, this is happening, then that was happening before, and, well, if things are going according to schedule, you know, this will happen next, and then it happened. And then the next stage of insight was really significant. And for a period of time of several days, I couldn't find any locus of identity at all here. None. And it was a very, very interesting experience. The experience, just on the level of direct experience, it's like the wind is blowing through this, and the birdsong is flowing through this. The sun is shining through this. And, you know, it's that idea of we forget the self so that we can be one with all things. Well, that actual experience of no longer having a locus of identity is amazing. A friend picked me up at the end of the retreat, and I was sharing this a little bit with him, and he's quite skeptical. And he said, well... he said, does the chainsaw buzz through it too? And I said, yeah. and I said, yeah, and the drones drop their bombs through it, and the torturers torture through it. There really isn't a sense of separation. And then gradually over time, there's more of a sense of psychic gravity, as it were. And I think that's why I'm so interested in this subject, because it's so lovely being without a self. And you know, so what is it that keeps us from getting rid of this very, very, very limiting and painful delusion? And I think... it's basically, it has to do with fear. Just, you know, think of our collective identities in this room. You know, we're different genders, and we're different races, and we're different ages, and we're different classes, and we're different sexual identities. We have different abilities in terms of being able or disabled in some ways. We have all these different identities, and think how important every one of them is to us. And what amazing, you know, just not only to us personally, but socially and politically, how important it is, these identities are. And imagine waking up one morning and discovering that you're a different gender. What would that be like? Or imagine waking up one morning and being a different race or a different sexual identity. Do you have some sense about how important it is to us, both, you know, just in both to us personally, these identities, and it's very important for us to honor these identities. Whatever your identities are, they are absolutely wonderful identities. It's very important for us to honor them, but it's also in some ways important for us to carry them lightly. You know, like changes of clothing. Oh, this one is male this time, and it happens to be old this time, and it's gay this time, and so I honor all of those identities in myself. It's a strange racial mixture of Danish and Polynesian, and so I honor all of those identities here as I honor the identities of everyone I meet, and yet it's really somehow important to see that they're only identities. And as we do this practice more and more, that sense of identity becomes somewhat more open and plastic and fluid. So I don't think of this body as male, but I don't necessarily think of this psyche as being just male. You know, it's more and more I can recognize the feminine qualities of this psyche. So if these identities are important to us, imagine how important and much more fundamentally important and profoundly important to us is the identity of self. The whole Western civilization exists basically to reinforce this identity, especially in the West, you know, especially here in the United States. We're such individualists. It's all about self-expression and self development and self-gratification, and you know, the whole society is basically here to reinforce this identity. And then for us personally, it's really important. And if we actually start to go through the process, which happens in meditation, the actual process of deconstructing this delusion, and it happens gradually, and then at times it happens very dramatically, it gets really scary. Really scary. There's a kind of existential crisis. Well, if I don't exist, then there's some kind of big black hole here. You know, it's like it's essentially the fear of losing our sense of self is a fear of annihilation. And over again, I've watched this psyche go through that fear, and I've basically counseled and guided and supported many, many others to go through that fear, which is in some ways the deepest fear we can experience. So fear. And a lot of people, you know, I don't think Calvin would last very long in our retreat, you know, because the key to happiness is short-term stupid self-interest. You know, he wouldn't last in a Vipassana retreat, I tell you. But lots of people basically decide, yeah, I don't want to go here. I was dealing with someone recently in a retreat who came and said, you know, when I was young, it was all an emotional roller coaster. And now that I'm older, things have really gotten stabilized and pretty even. And then now I'm in this meditative work and it's another damn roller coaster. And why should I be doing this? And I said, well, you're confusing the personal with the transpersonal. You know, when you were young, you went through all the emotional roller coaster. Now you're dealing with universal stuff. You know, everything's impermanent, everything is unsatisfactory because it's impermanent, and there's no self here. And all of those things are scary. And essentially, she said, you know, I don't need this. And I said, well, okay, you don't need it. You know? And I said, the Dharma has its hooks in you. You could leave, but I know you'll be back. You know, and she stayed. She managed to stay. She stayed with that fear. So I think fear is one thing that keeps us from getting free from this constricting delusion. There's another thing that relates to the fear, but it really has to do with the extraordinary narcissism of these minds. The English writer, whose pseudonym was Wei Wu Wei, said 99.9% of everything you think and everything you do is for yourself, and there isn't one. And you know, think of it. Just think of it. How much of our thoughts and how much of our concern and how much of our stories, and it's all about this. And it's very hard for us to somehow move beyond that. Laurie Anderson, you know, the performance artist Laurie Anderson, who's been around for decades and decades, had a performance in Santa Fe a few weeks ago. And a story that she told in her performance was, for me, very moving. She described being 12 years old in New York City and going to the pool and watching people do back dives. And she thought, I could do that. And she did a back dive off the diving board, and instead of landing in the water, she landed on concrete and broke her back. And she describes, you know, being in the children's ward at the hospital and how very difficult it was, and what the doctors did to her and what the nurses did to her. She told this whole story. And then she said that years and years later, something triggered her, and she suddenly was utterly reliving the experience many years later of being 12 years old in the children's ward of the hospital with a broken back. Only this time she experienced, you know, the smells and the sights and the sounds. But what she saw were children dying. Lots of children with cancer, children whimpering and crying through the night. You know, of waking up in the morning and a bed being empty and the nurses scurrying around to make it and, you know, get rid of any traces that somebody had actually been there. And she said that for all those years, she'd been telling the story of breaking her back and being in the hospital, and the story was all about herself. And then what she discovered with this revisiting experience was there was an enormous amount of other things that were happening there at the same time. And she said, you know, our remembering can be more forgetting than anything else. And that she had had the blessing of remembering, sort of bringing the members back together. And so the first locus of concern was utterly self. And then the locus of concern was everybody. We are everybody. So I think what happens in this, as we do this practice, as we do the mindfulness practice, what happens quite naturally by doing the mindfulness practice is that we deconstruct what we call self. You know, if you observe the body long enough, at some point you realize the body is only a body. It's not my body. It will just be clear, just from observing it. And if you observe thoughts long enough, you realize they're only thoughts. They're not my thoughts. If you really not only get involved in the story of the thought, but the process of the thought, you realize, well, you don't have any control over them. And the same with emotions. Even though we're so enormously identified with emotions, at some point you realize it's the fear. You know, the fear that you experience and the fear I experience is exactly the same experience. So to say my fear and your fear doesn't make sense. It's just fear. So this, and then, you know, sort of the last redoubt of self, the last defense of self is that which observes. So maybe the body isn't me and mine, maybe the thoughts and the emotions aren't me and mine, but whatever's watching is me. And at some point, the watching quality, the quality of awareness or mindfulness turns on itself and observes itself. And then it becomes obvious that's not self either. So there's this deconstruction process that happens quite naturally, simply by observing. But there's another way of working, and this is what I'd like to suggest this evening. There's another way of deconstructing the self. And that is, you know, we talk about the Dharma is basically, it's like a bird with two wings. There's the wing of wisdom, of awareness and wisdom, of understanding what is true. And then there's the wing of love and compassion. And the bird actually can't fly without both. And we tend to emphasize wisdom a whole lot. This talk has been mostly about wisdom. But we can also deconstruct our sense of self. We can escape that sense of separation. We can sort of kick open the coffin door of self through the quality of empathy, which is exactly what Laurie Anderson was describing. You know, her original version of her story was all about what this was feeling, and then the later version of her story was really feeling what others were feeling. Feeling what it was like to be dying and whimpering through the night as a child. You know, untouched, dying alone in a bed. So I'd like to suggest, you know, just as a kind of experiment, if you decide to come back when I'm here next time I come, I think I come in July, I'm not sure. Yeah, late July. If you plan to come back the next time I'm here, I'd like to suggest that we actually really take on as a practice the practice of empathy. And that is simply to open to what others are feeling. You know, we can extend empathy toward ourselves because very often we don't know what we're feeling, you know, just paying attention, oh dear, what are you feeling? Oh, I'm feeling sadness right now. You know, being able to recognize that, extending empathy to ourselves, but actively moving out of our self-concern and actually paying attention to what others are feeling. Not only the humans, but perhaps also the non-humans, the animals. Not only the people that you encounter in an immediate way, but, you know, what are the people on the streets of Tehran feeling? You know, it's not only the demonstrators who are out there trying to have their freedom and to have a democracy, but what are the repressive regime? What are they feeling? What are the soldiers feeling and the police feeling and whatever that awful militia is that's been, you know, using axes on people? What are they feeling? You know, really, instead of just sort of seeing it on the TV, is really saying, what is going through the hearts of these people? Or, you know, just a simple example. Sometimes I shop at Smith's and Taos, Smith's supermarket. And actually, I shopped in Costco today. So you're going through the line at the checkout counter at Smith's, and the person who's the cashier is actually standing on their feet hour after hour after hour. And they're essentially dealing, just observe it, they're dealing with people who are so shut down emotionally for the most part in the checkout line. You know, they might look at the cashier in the eyes, but they might actually go through the whole transaction without ever looking at that person. You know, so the cashier becomes an extension of the machine that they're working. You know, they're just a machine, but there's actually a human being with lots of feelings there. And it can be just such an interesting thing to say to someone, gee, it must be hard to stand so many hours. And I've gotten such amazing responses from people that it's like, you know, sort of looking up at me, you know, I'm acknowledging their experience. And you know, somebody says, yeah, my feet are killing me. Well, I hope you get a break soon. And there's this, you can feel this enormous gratitude that someone has acknowledged their existence. And not only acknowledged their existence, but acknowledged what they may be feeling. And it's that simple. You know, somehow or other, we don't do that. I was at the battery store today. I live in a really remote place, so when I come to this town, believe me, I'm rushing around from one place to another, and I needed a battery for my phone. And I finally got to the battery place. It was the third place I'd gone to. And they happened to have the battery. And I said, I am really glad you're here. You know, because I live way out in the country, and I really need a battery for my phone. I said, I'm really glad you're here and that you have this battery. It was just acknowledging someone and acknowledging their existence, appreciating that they're there. Just, it's that simple. So in your intimate relationships, you know, if you're with somebody who is very important to you, your sexual partner or an intimate friend, what are they feeling? Coming out of this self-absorption, the narcissism that so much that we're so conditioned to have, not to judge that in any way, it's fine, we're all narcissists, but not to judge it, but to see how we can break out of it and say to someone, gee, it looks like you're feeling sad, or I can see you're really happy this morning. You know, I have a friend, an intimate friend, who takes a long time getting started in the morning, and I tend to be obnoxiously cheerful in the morning. You know, I get comments from him like, you know, could you just tone it down a little bit? So, well, I understand. I see that it's a little hard for you to get started this morning. I'll be quiet for the next half hour. So, you know, it's just that simple. And I'd like to suggest that we do that practice, do the practice of empathy, and be creative about it. Take notes. And when I come next time, you know, I'll do a little rap about empathy, but what I'd really like to do is to hear from you about what was your experience. Is it pretty clear what the task is? I mean, look up empathy in the dictionary or whatever and get really familiar with the concept. And particularly if you want to look at the website of Nonviolent Communication, so much about of nonviolent communication is about empathy. So they'll go on and on in a really fruitful way about what empathy is and how to practice it. Well, thank you. Thank you for your patience. Any comments? Just
I have a request.
Yeah, please speak up.
There's a chant I'm very fond of, and it starts out with Anicca Vara Sankara.
Yeah.
And I forgot the word for word translation in English. Could you please?
Yeah, it's this chant is Anicca Vara Sankara Upadavaya Damino Upakitava Niruchanti Kesang Upasamo Sukho. And it was actually words that the Buddha spoke on the very last night of his life, just before he died. And he was, in a way, he was summing up his teaching. And the one translation of those words is, all conditioned things are impermanent. It is their nature to arise and pass away. To understand this truth brings true happiness. Yeah, it's wonderful. Anything else? Any other comments? Or please.
In your analogy with states being a concept, from the point of view of land, states don't exist. Stress that analogy over to no self and say what corresponds to the land.
Yeah, essentially, there's a reality here. It's an undivided reality. You know, essentially, there is only one reality here. And what we do because of our mental concepts is that we divide reality into you and me. And on some level, on the relative level, we can't avoid that. You know, we can't avoid the language of you and me and I. On the relative level, it does have a kind of contingent reality, but on the absolute level, it has no reality whatsoever. We're all very familiar with the relative, so I've been hammering away at the absolute. But it's the same thing. There is not a me here. Ultimately, it is just part of an undivided whole. Just as the land is whole, but we divide it into separate states because we have created a mental concept of states. Does that make sense? Okay, friends, thank you for your patience.
Thank you.